This is the third in our series of at Microsoft conversations on privacy. We had one in last summer and one in the fall, and we hope to do more of them. This time we're doing this event in partnership with Berkeley, the University of California at Berkeley, and George Washington University, and we want to thank them for all of their help and coordination in this event. It's been really good. We're looking forward to a very interesting and sort of timely conversation this morning on the question of how best to address the challenges associated with personally identifiable information, PII, as Frank said. This is, you know, I think it's a particularly interesting and important topic, and it comes at an interesting time when governments around the world are grappling with this set of issues and how to deal with information privacy in the digital age. And Microsoft is very happy to have the opportunity to provide the forum this morning and to host this conversation. We'll begin the session today by inviting Professors Paul Schwartz and Daniel Solov from UC Berkeley and from George Washington University to present the paper, and then we'll follow with a panel discussion. In the paper, Professor Schwartz and Solov argue that while PII is one of the central concepts in information privacy regulation, it's not been well defined. And that presents a variety of challenges that's somewhat difficult in a number of circumstances. And they use their article to develop a concept of PII 2.0, which seeks to create flexible buckets of identified information, identifiable information, and non-identified information, or non-identified data. And their concept is to apply protections to each of these buckets based on the risk of the data in the bucket and the context in which that data exists. The panel, which will follow the discussion, will consist of Manisha Mithal from the Federal Trade Commission, Chris Calabrese from the ACLU, and Reid Freeman, who is an attorney at Morgan Forster. And we'll follow that panel discussion with a brief QA or a short QA from the audience, and hopefully it'll be quite fun. So with that, I'm going to turn the panel over to the professors, who will give us the overview of their paper, and we'll go from there. Oh, I wanted to say a few words of introduction about each of you. Sorry, I almost forgot that. So Paul Schwartz is a professor of law at the University of California, the Berkeley Law School, and a director of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology. He's a leading international expert on informational privacy and information law. He's published widely on these topics. And in this country, his articles and essays have appeared in periodicals such as the Harvard Law Review, the Yale Law Journal, the Stanford Law Review, and the NYU Law Review. Daniel Solov is the John Marshall Harlan Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School. He's also a senior policy advisor at Hogan Lovells. And additionally, he's the founder of Teach Privacy, a company that provides privacy and data security training programs to businesses, law schools, healthcare institutions, law firms, healthcare institutions, and schools and other organizations. Professor Schwartz and Solov have also collaborated on other projects, co-authoring the casebook Information Privacy Law and the Concise Guide Privacy Law Fundamentals, which they both published together last year. So with that, I'd like to turn the panel over, and thank you for joining us.
Welcome, everybody. It's great to see you. I thought that at a center devoted to innovation and technology, what would be better than to start off with an illustration of Dick Tracy and his two-way wrist radio? And this actually, I was just reading the comic book with Dick Tracy to my seven-year-old son, and it turns out the two-way wrist radio came up. It was invented by Chester Gould, the author of Dick Tracy, in 1946. And there we were in Berkeley. I was reading the comic book to my son, and it was really, really hard to explain why the two-way wrist radio was so cool. Because he's grown up with all kinds of different smartphones, and he finally doesn't realize that on the smartphone there's a clock. So he thought that the killer app of the two-way wrist radio was that you could actually have a clock and a smartphone and have it on your wrist. So if they ever want to bring that back, you can sell it to a seven-year-old in California. Now, what this has to do with our paper, however, is that what really one of the central points that we started from was the notion that the line between personal information and non-personal information was not fixed, but it depended on how technology changed. right? And so the technology of the two-way wrist radio, if you think about it, 1946, when I was reading about it in the late 60s in Queens, it seemed pretty cool even then, 20 years later. And then if you think how much change and innovation there's been in the last 5 years alone, the rate has changed. It's picked up so much. And so if you have this basic legal category of PII, non-PII, and the applicability of whether or not all of privacy law is going to apply is going to then depend on this very hard off and on switch. We realized in our paper that we had a big problem because you would either get maybe too much privacy law when the switch was on and maybe too little or no privacy law because you decided the switch was off and there was no personal information, but technology was going to change that, you were going to have a big problem in privacy law. Hence, we decided we had to take on head on this problem of what is PII. And now I'll turn the presentation over to my co-author.
So the first thing that we wanted to do when we looked at this problem was to first recognize just the importance of PII. PII is such a central concept in the law today. It's almost inescapable. It's the trigger for when a wide array of privacy laws and privacy regulation will apply to something. If it's personally identifiable information, that's when the law provides all sorts of regulations and protections. And when there isn't PII, basically, it's a pumpkin. It gets nothing. And so this is a very important, often dividing line between a lot of protection and no protection. And one of the big problems in the law is that even though it's so contingent and it's so important for the law, the law itself doesn't really have a good definition of what PII is. And so one of the things we started with is, well, how does the law go about trying to understand or define PII, which is its basic applicability? And what we saw was, in fact, that we looked at the various approaches in the law, and we came up with three categories, three types of approaches that the law applies. And we basically think all of them are pretty bad. So the first one is what we call the tautological approach, is when the law basically says that personally identifiable information is anything that identifies the individual. The problem with that approach is it's question begging. It basically says, well, PII is PII. But it doesn't really tell us, well, what does it mean to identify the individual, which is the key question. What is, in fact, identifying an individual, and to what degree is it identifying an individual? And that the test doesn't really answer the question. It just begs it. So as a result, the tautological approach is useless. So that then makes us look at other approaches. Another approach, which it's not even clear it was really even focused on PII, but it's often used, and that is the non-public approach, which is the idea, well, we'll try to regulate information that's non-public. This is the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act approach. But if it's public information, then you know all bets are off. The problem is that the line between public and non-public really has almost nothing to do with whether information is identifiable or not. And so as a result, I think that approach is deeply flawed because the issue that it's looking at really doesn't match very well to the issue of what's identifiable. Which brings us to the third approach, which is a very popular approach in the law, which is then to list and define specific types of PII. We call it the specific type approach, which is to say, well, PII consists of this and this and this and this. And a lot of data security breach laws and passed in the states use this approach, saying, well, PII includes a name or a first or last name and then some kind of additional element like a social security number. It comes up with a list of these are the things that are PII and these are the things that are not PII, and it just defines it. The problem with this approach is that as Paul said, technology changes, things change, and the specific types today might not be work for tomorrow, or they might be badly drawn specific types that the legislature often, I think a lot of the data security breach laws are, you know, kind of already obsolete, the, you know, even before they were written, because their very approach is wrong in terms of what's identifiable and what's not. So I think the specific types approach fails in that trying to delineate specific types has not been very good in practice. What has been delineated in a lot of laws often is under-inclusive. And in addition, one of the challenges is the world of changing technology, which is a point that I'm going to turn to next. And it's the point that really complicates this entire debate and makes it a big challenge for how do we move forward on PII. So I want to talk a little bit about this problem, which is this problem of de-identification, and it really comes up in this context a lot. And that is that it's very difficult, and people experience great difficulty in de-identifying data, in trying to get information that isn't identifiable in some way. And one of the, there have been several studies, very prominent studies about de-identification, and they reveal some startling results, and results that make this debate very complicated. One is a study by LaTanya Sweeney, where she was able to identify a very high percentage of people with the following three pieces of data: gender, date of birth, and zip code. And that can identify quite a large percentage of individuals. So it really shows that you don't need a whole lot to, in fact, turn information and make it identifiable. And it's often different combinations of pieces that could, it's not just one piece that's identifiable, it could be combinations of pieces in different combinations. So that makes it complicated. Another study that was done was a study involving Netflix movie ratings. And Netflix, you might have heard, is a movie provider, and it's also, I think it's known as Quickster. Now it's, it's Netflix. It's not clear what it's, it's but Netflix released de-identified data about people's movie ratings. And researchers were able to take that information and identify something like 80% of the people who had rated three or more movies. How did they do this? What happened? Well, what they did was they found sources online where people had rated movies and revealed their identities. And then they matched that data to the data on the Netflix study, the de-identified Netflix data, and presto, they were able to figure out who the people were. And this really gets to one of the heart of, and the trick of the tricky part of de-identification, that it really depends on context. It depends on the data that's out there already, because the more data out there about a person that is identified, I have, you know, various things I wrote online, various information about me online where my name is attached. Now, if you throw out a set of data that is de-identified, but those same details appear in it, it becomes easier to identify that data. And so the Netflix study was able to link up the data because there existed a site called Internet Movie Database, or IMDb, where people rated movies and used their names. If IMDb didn't exist, the researchers likely would not have been able to achieve the result that they did. And this is, I kind of liken this to some extent to the problem of the kind of pollution outside the Earth with satellites. You know, there's all this satellite debris, and now it's becoming increasingly likely that if you go up there, there's a greater risk of